We, the Department of Justice, including the FBI, and Department of Homeland Security, including CISA, have no evidence that any foreign government-affiliated actor prevented voting, changed votes, or disrupted the ability to tally votes or to transmit election results in a timely manner, altered any technical aspect of the voting process, or otherwise compromised the integrity of voter registration information of any ballots cast during the 2020 federal elections. Broad Russian and Iranian campaigns targeting multiple critical Broad Russian and Iranian campaigns targeting multiple critical infrastructure sectors did compromise the security of several networks that manage some election functions, but they did not materially affect the integrity of voter data, the ability to vote, the tabulation of votes, or the timely transmission of election results. Iranian claims that sought to undermine the public's confidence in U.S. election infrastructure were false or inflated. A joint report of the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security on foreign interference in the 2020 U.S. elections is reassuring, but how vulnerable have U.S. elections been, and how vulnerable will they be in 2022 and beyond? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Young-Mi Kim, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Now, all this talk about, it seems, I should say, that all this talk about various kinds of election tampering, whether it's fraud or some kind of, you know, mechanical failure or anything else, seems to have come full-blown in 2016 and ramped up in 2020. And in 2022, both parties and places are already developing plans for challenging election returns. How long has this phenomenon been with us?
So election fraud is not a new phenomenon. It has been with us like for a long time. There are always like a partisan biases about interpretation of the election result or the legitimacy of the systems and the promises or the reliability of the outcomes. And especially losers like always complain about the result and then the outcomes are not reliable and things like that. So in the past, these conspiracies or, election denials remain sort of outside of the system. These days, we see these election fraud claims on social media all the time. And then when you go to the polls, and then poll watchers or ballot box watchers are trying to harass voters just to verify the election voting processes. It reached the point abuse of the system. So that's why we are very concerned about.
And how do you actually go about analyzing the effects, let's say, or lack thereof, of these factors that people are claiming have to do with there's fraud on the one hand, or maybe just inaccuracy on the other, or the motives notwithstanding? How do you go about assessing, analyzing what's going on?
My team focuses on social media. Election fraud claims on social media, what they are talking about, who are spreading disinformation, and who are targeted and exposed to election fraud claims, what's the effect of election fraud claims or exposure to election fraud claims on social media. The challenge is that unlike broadcast media, social media posts essentially only are shown to targeted individuals. And even on Twitter, TikTok, you have to you have to go there, and then like you have to follow certain like people. Then like, well, algorithm feed you like some posts. So it's not like publicly available. So like there is no like a centralized place like where researchers can monitor what's really going on in the social media ecosystem. So we developed an app that just like worked like an ad blocker, but then it instead of blocking the ads, but it actually like detects the ads like people are exposed to, and also some unpaid promotion like organic posts like people are exposed to on social media while they are just normally using like social media.
So you're seeing these things from what, the 2016 election, 2020?
Yeah, we've been observing this like since 2016. Yeah, so by using this app, we were able to capture not only the content of the social media posts that people are exposed to, but also associated meta information like a timestamp, but also who are the sources, like who are behind this, like this post, and then we also collect like people's this. This is like a user-based app, so like, you know, people are recruited, and then these are a sample of people who represent the U.S. voting age population, and then they were asked to use this app like at least like for 2 weeks like before the election, and then after the election, like, we do like surveys of these people, so that by matching their exposure to like a certain social media content with their responses on surveys, like their demographics and political ID and political ideology, interests, and all kinds of political and social attitudes, we could develop some model that unpacked like targeting patterns, like who are targeted, but also what are the factors that influences their exposure, and then what are the consequences of the exposure to particular content on social media.
So you have to determine somehow what the effect of all of these social media posts are on the actual election. I mean, it's one thing to do a survey and find out all about the people who are listening to or somehow being exposed to these posts, these contacts on social media. But what it all comes down to in terms of the vote is just one vote for that person. Did you have a sense of how they were actually going to vote, how effective these posts were in their voting, convincing them to vote?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you say effect, like it implies the cause and effect, like you know, the social, in this case, like the exposure to like let's say like election fraud, like claims on social media, leads to something, right? Like, but that is very hard to answer. Like it's really difficult to answer, and it's that causal inferences. Like it, you know, it's there is like a fundamental like a limitation in making like a causal claim based on you know, surveys or observation or studies. But because we collect like so much information, like you know, the content and exposure patterns, and then we could unpack like targeting patterns, and then you know these people's like you know demographics, and then match with like their attitudes, and then willingness to vote, and then all those kind of things. Like we could tease out a little bit, and then we could, you know, by using like advanced like a statistical techniques, like we can do a little bit closure to causal relationship beyond like you know just the simple correlations. So let's put that way. So okay, it is important to look at like you know content and then target like this like processes like you know bit by bit. So You know, we first looked at, like, you know, how widespread, like, election fraud claims on social media, like, for example. So in 2020, we collected about, like, 35 million, like, social media posts.
35 million?
Yes, like, exposed to about, like, 1,600, like, people. And these people, and then we see that we identify election fraud claims, like a stop the steal, or, you know, things like that. And then we realize that, like, about 70% of the sample, again, like, these people are representative to, like, a U.S. voting age population, so we can generalize to that.
So people who were targeted by these posts.
Yes, like, so at least, like, so 70% of people are exposed to at least one, like, election fraud claims on the social media.
70% of your sample.
Right. Which could be, like, generalizable to the population, U.S. voting age population. So it was like a widespread. And then, you know, it was like a real time tracking. So we got, like, a timestamp when this, like, a, you know, particular post or exposed to a particular, like, you know, people. And then we identify, like, some posts that are trying to organize, like, the Gen 6 insurrection. And then we saw that, like, as early as, like, in October. Obviously, like, we saw, like, surge of, like, this post that organized, like, a collective action around, like, this election fraud right after the election day. It was, very scary. And then this fraud, another thing that we found that it has the election fraud claims always has some kind of, like, us versus them kind of, like, a, you know, narrative structure.
Sure, in order to get people stirred up.
Right, right. And so, you know, Democrat versus, like, a Republican, you know, so basically, like, a stop the steal is, like, a Democrat, like, stole the election, right? Like, that's the whole narrative. But there was, like, a, you know, Fortin, like, China, like, interfered the election,
So we presume that those posts weren't coming from China.
Right. Like, so it's always, like, you know, us versus them. Which is very similar to, like, a mythology, like, a structure. So us versus them, and then someone, like, a god, like, you know, appeared, and then, you know, they tried to, like, solve the problem. So in this case, like, a Trump is going to solve, like, a problem and then defeat, like, a Democrats, and then that kind of
sort of a quick, easy fix.
Right. It's a typical conspiracy, deep state, like, you know, the stories, but those, like, a mythologic structure, which is very common in conspiracy theories, are well integrated into election fraud, like, claims. So it's easy to understand. And then we also found that, like, these election fraud claims, that, well, 70% of the voters were exposed to that, but mostly who got the most of, like, election fraud, those are older, especially, like, you know, older than, like, a 60 conservative and Republicans, and those who spend a lot of time on social media. But interestingly, those who don't trust in mainstream news media. So these people seem to use, like, a social media as an alternative, like, to mainstream news media.
Of course.
And then that was, like, a strongest predictor for exposure to, like, election fraud claims. So obviously these people don't trust media, and then don't tend to, like, trust, like, a government in general. That kind of a conspiracy beliefs, like, fits very well with, like, election fraud claims. So we don't know whether these are the narratives of, like, election fraud that's clearly, like, developed, like, mm-hmm. by some organizations or campaigns, rather than just, like, you know, people just, like, you know, organically develop, like, stories over time. There is some evidence for that, like, I'm not sure, because we also analyzed the authors or sponsors of the ads, like, who are talking about, like, election fraud in the social media. And then these are all, like, unknown, like, unregistered, like, groups. Or
you can't determine where these posts are coming from?
Most of them we couldn't identify who they are, so which is very problematic, because some of them are doing ads, and then this was, like, you know, our data collection period, like, it hit, like, a, you know, so-called, like, Federal Election Commission windows, like, FEC windows, like, they have to disclose, like, they themselves, but, like, we couldn't find them. And then most of them are quote-unquote, like, grassroots organizations, which poses, like, another, like, a challenge, like, to social media companies. Like, for example, this would be just, like, you know, the organization of the Gen 6, like, you know, insurrection, for example, even though it was, like, very violent. So I'm sure, like, social media companies probably took down some attempt to organize, like, a violent action. But some of the election fraud, like, even the organization of the Gen 6, like, before it happened, like, nobody knew that it would have, like, that much of, like, you know, violence. So these posts are not taken down. So that's why, like, we are able to capture them in real time. It was, like, a very concerning. But the authors, like, seem to be, or distributors seem to be, like, pretty much, like, organized, like, groups. Like, but we don't know who they are exactly.
Are you seeing them again as we get towards 2022 elections?
Oh, yes. Yes, and then some of them are now, like, doing, like, offline, you know, activities as well. So, you know, we keep, like, doing this, like, you know, and then planning to do, if we get, like, a, you know, enough, like, a research funding. So it looks like delegitimization is the theme, or, like, a, you know, quote-unquote, like, a trend in, like, this election. So, and then even, like, you know, people who are running for the office are openly, like, claiming, like, you know, election fraud. It's definitely, like, a polarizing topic. And then another thing, like, I'm very concerned about is, like, you know, I'm sure, like, you've seen this, like, you read, like, stories about, you know, what's going on in Arizona. So, you know, this, like, a ballot box, like, watchers were harassing, like, voters, like, in Arizona, and intimidating them, like, you know, it's like,
just by being there, you mean over
watching supposed to, yes, they're supposed to watch, ballot, like, to protect, like, election from
irregularities of any kind, I suppose.
Exactly, right. But they're taking photos and then, like, you know, ask, you know, following, like, the voters, like, you know, and then just, like, and then threaten them to find, like, you know, home and then those kind of things. So, like, you know, some groups, like, you know, filed a complaint. So this, like, election fraud, like, claims are interwoven with, like, some voter suppression tactics. Like, a voter intimidation is a typical voter suppression tactic. So in order to suppress, like, you know, a vote from, like, a particular coalition or mostly, like, you know, the opposition side, like, you pose, like, a threat, like, intimidation, or spread, like, misinformation. In 2018, like, for example, there was a lot of, like, you know, social media posts that, like, ISIS will be there, so, like, you know, the first voters, like, first immigrant, like, voters are afraid to, like, go out to vote, and, like, bring your gun to the poll, like, to protect, like, you know, the invalid, like, you know, voters and things like that. So this typical voter suppression, intimidation, threat tactics are integrated with like election fraud claims. I think that it has like a significant influence like on like people's minds and behavior. So, for example, in the same study and in the 2020 election, like, so we match it. We identify the people who are exposed to election fraud claim on social media, and then we match it with like their exposure to social media, exposure to like, election fraud claims on social media with people's responses on election legitimacy. Well, first of all, Democrats and Republicans have like a completely different like realities. But even after controlling for all these like a quote-unquote usual suspect like ideology and party ID and age or how much they trust in government, how much they trust in the media, how much they spend like on social media, all of these like factors that would influence either exposure to election fraud claims or beliefs in like election legitimacy. Even after controlling for all these factors, like we found that like the exposure to election fraud claims in the social media alone decreases like the beliefs in an election legitimacy. So if more you're exposed to election claims, the more you doubt about like the system and the process and
so
the outcome of the election.
So they're effective. These posts.
Yes, and then effect was like there was so-called like an inaction effect. Like effect was amplified among like Republicans. So Democrats, they are also like affected by it. The exposure to election fraud claims, but Republicans are a lot more affected by these like election fraud claims. It did decrease the like, legitimacy, people's beliefs in like, election legitimacy, and election legitimacy is the core democratic value.
Like, right.
So it is very concerning. Another study I want to introduce is not election fraud study, but it focuses on like more of like voter suppression tactics. Like, so it's a 2016 study, same kind of method, like techniques that we used. This time, this study actually tracked like, our participants' actual turnout record back in 2016, and then matched people's like turnout record with their exposure patterns like to voter suppression messages on social media, and then voter suppression messages like include that intimidation and threats, but also election boycotts, like election doesn't matter, and then election doubt, all those kind of things. So we found that, and then this is like a very unique technique. Like statistically, we've sort of like found like a pair, like a twin. It's like exactly same people, like two people, exactly same in terms of like demographic profiles or political party ID, except whether they are exposed to voter suppression message or not. So by comparing their actual turnout rate, it's because everything else like equal, we could gauge like how much the exposure to voter suppression message on the social media would have affected the turnout. And then we found that about like a 2% decrease in turnout if you are exposed to like a voter suppression
2%.
Message. Yes, on like a social media. Yeah, so like a 2%, this is like a national average. So 2%
some
might
elections,
be like
it would make a difference.
Exactly.
Especially in these times of very close elections.
Right. So like some might say, 2%, nothing. it's a small number, but it's non-negligible number. And then more interesting thing was that these voter suppression messages are concentrated among like non-white voters in battleground states. So, you might have heard about like Russians like you know did like a voter suppression and some you know some campaigns that could use like a voter deterrence, which is same as like a voter suppression like tactics, but it's not like a why it was not widespread. It's very narrowly targeted. So like you know non-whites, not every like a non-white, but like a non-whites who were living in a battleground state, especially like you know non-whites who are living in minority, racially, ethnically minority, majority colonies in battleground states. So it's very complicated, but it's very narrowly targeted. So when we focus on these people, the turnout like it decreased almost by nearly like a 10%.
10%.
Yeah. So it was like a very yes. So it was like a very narrowly targeted. So not many voters. But if you think about like you know 2016 election, like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, like a margin of a vote to less than 5%, and in some states have you know about like a 1% like a margin. So this is, I think, it's like a you know huge impact. So we think about like when we think about like an impact like, or effect, and then. We always just think about like a broad impact, but you know we're living in we no longer live in like a broad impact era. It's like no one like there is no such a thing that influences like everyone in the United States. So these messages are targeted, and then when these messages are somehow like resonant with like existing beliefs, you know, resentment, then like it, you know, the effect would be like amplified.
We're going to look further at this research into election integrity when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Welcome back to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, and my guest is Youngmi Kim. She's a professor in the School of Journalism and Communications at the UW-Madison. She has been looking at the claims of voter fraud and just various other ways of addressing, and in some cases, attempting to undermine U.S. elections. And early on, Youngmi, you mentioned this group that you're working with that's doing this research, very extensive research having to do with the effects of social media. What exactly is this group?
Yeah, this is Project Data, digital ad tracking and analysis. Like now we are tracking not only ads, but also organic posts as well. So this is a research group at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Very interdisciplinary, like, you know, faculty and students like, from social science and computer science and statistics. And then we have been working on working on the role of like, digital campaigns, digital political campaigns play in data-driven, algorithm-based, and then micro-targeting-based, like based platforms, based like politics. Yeah.
And when did you begin this study?
We started 2015 for 2016 elections. Like you know, our pilot study was launched like you know just before Super Tuesday, 2016. Yeah.
And in 2015. What was the impetus? Was there enough claim out there, enough of a phenomenon to observe already then?
So 2016 election, I mean, this was like my dream project. Like, so I...
Somebody else's nightmare project.
right. Yeah, it's like, well, the whole story is like, you know, it's a drama. So I have been like working on like passionate people who care about politics because of their, you know, religious values or racial identity or sometimes like a self-interest, like, you know, con owners, you know, name them like a conviction publics, like, you know, people who tend to have a very strong opinions about like a certain issues. And then, you know, in public opinion research or political communication research, like these people are understudied because you know, people treat them like, oh, there's just a small number of people, and then they're, yeah, maybe they're out there, but, you know, they are very different. But then, like, with the so-called, like, a big data revolution, I realized that even low-resourced, like, groups, like advocacy groups or nonprofits, could identify and target and then mobilize these passionate publics, like, through social media. My original research question was about, like, how these, like, you know, advocacy groups or non-party actors, like, are trying to identify passionate publics. Because, like, for campaigners, like, it'd be much easier to identify, target, and mobilize passionate publics rather than, like, focusing on, like, people who are not so much interested in politics, because these people are already interested in politics.
They'll be outspoken.
Right. So my research proposal was originally just about, like, you know, micro-targeting and then how these people are targeted, by whom. But then, like, my team, like, you know, quote-unquote, accidentally, like, you know, discovered, like, a Russian election interference because Russians targeted these people.
Well, yes. Tell us what you found in terms of this 2016 election, Russian interference. What was this Russian interference made of? How many posts are we talking about? How many contacts? What kind of efforts? And what were they putting across as a message?
So how many posts, like, you know, I would say we still don't know exactly how many posts, like, they distributed, like, among the public. According to the government, like, a congressional investigation, which was relying on, like, you know, platforms, like, self-submitted, like, data, it was not widespread. Probably that's true because, like, it was election interference seemed to pretty much, like, a targeted campaigns, not like a, you know, this is very different than, like, a Russian today, which is, like, a propaganda, like, you know, broadcast media. What I found is a so-called, like, asymmetric mobilization. So, like, we have to understand, like, a Russian propaganda or Russian information operation as like a two route, like a dual route, like, you know, activities. So one, it's, you know, Russians always with us. Like, you know, it's not like they come and go.
They're always up to something.
Yes. like a Russian today. But during the election, it seems like their strategy is, like, a, you know, broadly speaking, like an asymmetric mobilization. So particularly in, like, 2016, they mobilize Trump agenda. Not particularly, like, a Trump per se, like a candidate.
The agenda, but not the candidate.
Not the candidate, right. Like, but the Trump agenda, like a nationalism, American first, anti-LGBT, anti-immigration, things like that. Targeting low-income people. And then they're very specific, like a gun ads, like, a focus on gun owners in rural Wisconsin, like, for example.
They could narrow it down that closely.
Right. And then, on the other hand, like, they suppress their vote from likely Clinton voters, especially non-white voters. So that's, like, a voter suppression.
What were they after then? If they're touting what we'll call a Trump agenda, but not necessarily the candidate, on the one hand, and they're trying to suppress the vote that would be against that agenda, what were and perhaps are the Russians after?
Basically, like, voter suppression is like a coalition-breaking strategy. So they tried to break Democratic coalition. So as a result, like, you know, you could argue like a turnout rate like among non-whites could be low. And in fact, like in 2016, like, you know, non-white voters, like a turnout was really low. And then like you mobilize like people, like, you know, passionate people who care about Trump agenda. So,
which I suppose you could argue is a way of fracturing the Republican Party.
Right. So it is a little bit complicated than like people assume. It's not like, you know, Russians like just to promote like a Trump, you know, it's not, or just to hate like a Clinton, you know, it's not like that. Because ultimately, their goal is to unstabilize like United States like a democratic system by sowing division, planting mistrust in like election systems, just like it's spreading confusion and doubt about the system. So that's their goal. So all these like issues like we are observing right now, you know, like a challenge, like election integrity, are all, you know, the part of like a foreign election interference, like a foreign election interference, like operations could explore it, like a political device, you know, election fraud claims and then conspiracies among us.
So that's Russia. Other countries haven't mentioned. We mentioned at the very beginning and dismissed Iran. And I think China has also been mentioned as possibly trying to interfere in U.S. elections one way or the other.
Right. So back in 2016, like a Russian election interference was relatively much more sophisticated than Iranian. I don't think like there was like a China election interference in 2016. But since 2020, we've seen China and Iran are mimicking like some of like Russian like tactics.
The same purpose, to destabilize elections, or some other means?
It's, you know, like Iranian and Chinese like election interference relatively easy to detect because they are taking like a very traditional like a propaganda style, like promoting their own agenda and then criticizing like, you know, the U.S. government, you know, that kind of thing. But they try this asymmetric mobilization or, you know, like coalition breaking. That is more like a Russian thing. So, like this, the FBI director calls it like a two-prong approach. Like, so on the one hand, like you target, you know, certain types of voters, and the other hand, they could target different types of voters. So that's like a two-pronged approach. That's very unique to Russia. This year, the Meta found like some Chinese like, election interference targeting United States, like pretending, you know, Americans or American like group political groups, and like, they are spreading some information that undermines like, you know, the trust in the system. So, which is similar to like what like, you know, the Russian election interference like aim to do. So I think like, you know, these other foreign actors like try to adopting, you know, some of the Russian techniques they think were successful in the past.
Are these attempts across the border, you say, you know, the Russians never go away, so it doesn't like necessarily go from election to election, but all along, I mean, we have midterm elections in between, or are they also sending out posts to undermine confidence in midterm elections?
midterm elections, it's we just don't know yet. Like I haven't, you know, analyzed the data yet. Just like an anecdotal observation. My guess, like in 2018, we didn't see much. You know, in 2020, we didn't see a lot. But like usually, there's like a 14 election interference. Like it focuses on like a presidential election, just because that's much easier. You know, because of the way our elections are unfolded, like a midterm election, there are too many players and then too many issues. So it's even like a for 14 operation, it's like a hard to focus on like, you know, like a thing. So that might be why. Yeah, it's like a midterm election. But this year, like you know, we don't know. Like it's unique that like you know we have like a you know, still like a Ukrainian war is still going on. So in fact, like you know, Meta like found like some largest like a Russian operation targeting Europe, but it was not like a targeting like the United States. So we don't know. Yeah, we'll see.
We'll look further for a few minutes at this phenomenon of election integrity or the attempts to undermine it when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Youngmi Kim, with the School of Journalism and Communications at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she and her group have been researching for 5 years now, actually more like 7 years, I guess, the phenomenon of social media attempts to affect one way or the other the elections in the United States. And when we say social media, there are a couple of things that come to mind, but where all do we find these posts, these messages having to do with the questioning of the validity of elections or just anything that would disseminate probably false information that would undermine confidence in the U.S. elections. Where all do we find these messages?
Yeah, so like when I say like social media, I am talking about like major digital platforms like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, like Google and Twitter, things like that. Yeah, so. Yeah, this media that you use like every day.
And you've been saying that somehow these entities, whether it's, I mean, we've been talking about Russia, Iran, China, but they won't necessarily be foreign actors that are putting these messages up there?
Oh, not necessarily. Okay, you know, some of them are foreign actors. Like, you know, for example, back in like 2016, we focus on this divisive issue as like a you know, gun or anti-immigration nationalism.
Is abortion up there too?
Abortion, yeah. And all so-called like wedge issues. And then who are doing this like issue campaigns on Facebook. And then again, like you know, our data collection period like hit like a FEC windows. Like we expect that majority of them like probably like you know, official candidate campaigns like who registered with the FEC. But in fact, like you know, that half of the sponsors were unknown, unidentifiable sponsors who did not register FEC. IRS, because some of the nonprofits, like tax exempt organizations, could do like public education campaigns. In that case, like they are exempted like from like a disclosure requirement. So
yes, I've seen that, like on something like Charity Navigator.
Mm-hmm, right. But then like you know, these groups are not even in like IRS like data. So. And then later, you know, when we match it, like their identity with the data House Intel Committee like released as like you know Russian actors, like you know, we found that one out of six, it's about like 17% of these sponsors turned out to be Russian-operated, you know, the campaign actors. So, yeah, these are unknown. And then, again, like, you know, in 2020, all these, like, election fraud claims are seem to be organized, like, distributed by, like, organizations or quote-unquote, like, grassroots organizations. Or, but these are largely, like, unknown groups.
Is there some central clearinghouse for identifying these? I realize that, you know, as soon as one is outed, so to speak, that it could change. But even so, would it be of value and would it be feasible to, you know, have a list someplace? Oh, if you have been contacted by organization X, by the way, that's a front for this.
Right, right. I think social media companies actually share that information with like people who were exposed to Russian election interference in 2016. So I think they probably keep doing that. So you know that if you are exposed to, like, a, you know, Russian election interference, like a, those kind of a post. But regarding like a centralized place, like I think that's a great idea. Seriously, because like if we think about like a broadcast like an ad, you know, one, it has a clear you know, disclaimer, at least like, you know, paid for by information, right? On the other hand, like all this, like a digital ad, like we collected nearly like 40% of them, like did not identify themselves like on the face of the ads. Like, so that means like if you really want to know who paid like who sponsored this ad, like you have to do research, your own, you know, research. But you know, Americans are, on average, like exposed to, like 30 like political ads like during the election campaign.
They would not get around to looking up.
You don't have time.
Any of them, let alone all of them.
Right. Yeah. So at least like we need to have some disclaimer rules. And then second, like broadcast ads like have some centralized like archives. Academics or nonprofits like who work on election integrity could always like, you know, do research and then see who are doing this, and then they track like campaign money, and you know what kind of messages are they doing, who are sending more negative messages than like, you know, positive messages and things like that. But again, as I said like earlier at the beginning of the show, you know, digital ads, particularly, and then all the digital posts, like, you know, by nature, these are only shown to people who are targeted or voluntarily opt in to receive that information. So there is no way you could, like, monitor the whole landscape of, like, you know, the social media information system. So if at least like ads, you know, because like ads are deliberate, like based on like a deliberate strategy, there is a clear intention to persuade like voters. At least the ads, I think we should have some centralized place for transparency. I'm not actually like a strong advocate for takedown like messages or censoring like content. Like, you know, I'd never advocate, you know, for censorship.
Don't some of the platforms
some of the platforms like have to do like, you know, hate speech or violence or, you know, organization of violent crimes. Like those kind of things like have to be taken down. But others like, you know, misinformation, you know, by definition, misinformation is like information that has a function of misleading, and it is like a hard to understand the like actual intention or intent of this.
Like, and separating opinion from
something
that's less worthy.
It's very difficult to do like a content moderation, but transparency would be the direction to go. So like, you know, archival like these ads. So some social media companies like Facebook now have like ad archives, like ad library, you know, out of like, you know, after like the since 2018, like after all this like public criticism on like, you know, Facebook, that they now have that. But another thing they could do better is, I think, like, algorithm transparency. So 2021, like last year, I think Francis Hagen, like a, you know, whistleblower, like, you know, former employee of like a Facebook and a whistleblower, testified at the Congress, and then she said, you know, the internal research like revealed that the algorithm, their, you know, meaningful social interaction system, in fact, amplify more extreme messages, and as a result, they could divide people. So, if we understand like how algorithm works, like, you know, that might be like a starting point like to combat like misinformation and election fraud claims and all this, like, you know, the claims that challenge, like, you know, election integrity. In Europe, like, you know, they are, you know, EU actually just like a, you know, proposed like a Digital Service Act, like, so which emphasizes like the algorithm transparency. So, like, you know, major platforms have to reveal, you know, how their algorithm works. So I think that would be a more productive way to combat, like, you know, misinformation.
In effect, you're cornering the entity putting up the post to identify itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that I could, you know, the Facebook, you know, Mark Zuckerberg. Well, I don't know, like, you know, but, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or, like, you know, their employers, like, intentionally, like, try to, like, spread, like, misinformation, like, you know, the algorithm.
It's just a lot to keep up with.
Yeah, the algorithm is just is developed in a way to generate more reactions that has consequences, and sometimes, like, you know, detrimental consequences, like, to democracy, like, because it promotes, like, strong reactions. And then people show, like, strong reactions to these conspiracies or election fraud campaigns, like, because it has, like, a good and evil structure. It's, like, that kind of narrative structure is easy to understand and easy to react. And then it targets, you know, passionate people, passionate public who care about those issues. Therefore, you know, it might, like, amplify, like, these messages, like, a sharing of these messages, and then, like, you know, as a result, like, it might promote, like, you know, polarization. We don't know.
2022 is going to be an interesting year for elections, and we'll see what the effects. It might take a while to find out, but we'll see what the effects of these challenges to election integrity turn out to be and how effective they turn out to be. Hyungmi Kim, thank you for giving us some insights into your research.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.